This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Good evening, everybody. A few repeats, I'm afraid to say, unavoidably. My charts are really simple, actually. I can't do complicated charts, you'll be pleased to hear. Not sure what that says about me. I'm going to kick off with recent price growth. So this is a chart that shows cumulative price change since January 2008, which, give or take, was the peak of the boom last time around. Now, just for a moment, I want to focus on the UK line, so the yellow line on the chart. Just remember that prices rose 175% in the 10 years to 2007. And since then, we've had the global financial crisis, the credit crunch, dramatic shrinkage of bank lending, and soaring deposit requirements. And the UK economy's had the most protracted downturn in modern history. And prices have fallen 11% after that 175% growth. They're now back to the same level they were at in the spring of 2006 in the UK, 18 months before the crash. It doesn't feel like a correction. It's not like Spain, the US, or Ireland, where prices have fallen 35% or 50% respectively, and all of which experience similar boom conditions. You move into London on the chart here, and it's even more unusual. Prices haven't even fallen in Greater London, and actually in central London, prices are 20% or more higher than they were at the peak of the last boom. So we've heard about real and nominal already. Here's some more. Not much of an adjustment in terms of nominal terms, but of course we ought to think about wider price movements and allow for inflation in the wider economy. And if we deflate prices by CPI since 2008, we see a bigger adjustment. So actually prices have corrected more significantly in real terms. But the reality, though, the problem with a real price adjustment, of course, is it's only really relevant if earnings keep pace with inflation, and they haven't. Inflation since January 2008 has been about 18%, and wages or earnings have risen by about 8%. So a fairer view of real price change is found if you deflate price growth by earnings growth rather than CPI. And on that basis, you can see the adjustment since 2008 has been limited in the UK and still negligible in London. Most people, I think, in this room would agree, or I hope would agree, that prices in the market are higher now than we anticipated at the beginning of the correction or the beginning of the crash. Now, one reason for this has already been touched on by Yolanda and also by James, which is affordability. We've got base rates in the UK at 0.5% since 2009. So the government have effectively put a floor under prices in the mainstream market. And at the same time, they've made it cheap for affluent buyers to buy into the central London market, many of whom have been sort of searching for a safe haven in turbulent times. And as you can see on this chart, affordability, as Yolanda's already touched on, in terms of the proportion of earnings dedicated to mortgage payments is pretty much at an all-time low and certainly below the long-run average for this measure. But the problem with mortgage costs as a measure of affordability is it's rather flawed, because it's rather dependent on the prevailing mortgage rate. And I assume most people in the room wouldn't assume that we're going to have a base rate of 0.5% forever and a day. We may have it for a number of years, but it won't be a feature of the market for, say, 10, 20 years. So to get a better idea of long-term pricing stability, I think we've got to go back to some of those old-fashioned affordability measures. The ratio of house prices to earnings, we're probably 20%, 25% above the long-run average, even more so in London. And the same goes for house prices to rents, probably 15% above the long-run average. On any sort of sensible measure, UK prices at the current time are expensive in historical terms. And since the rebound in pricing in 2009, we've stated that really we expect prices in the mainstream market to correct lower over time. Now, that correction so far has been delayed by ultra-low interest rates, but our view remains that it will happen. The question really is whether this correction happens in nominal terms over a short period or in real terms over a longer period. And I favour the latter scenario because it would seem there needs to be some kind of trigger event to push prices into a rapid correction. And without a euro breakup or a similar kind of scenario, it's difficult to expect anything other really than a process of slow, extended growth in prices below the rate of inflation, as James already alluded to. And I think the government hope that they can permit this more benign outcome from their point of view by holding rates low enough for long enough, allowing earnings time to rise, hopefully, so households can cope when eventually base rates and mortgage rates begin to increase. And if you doubt the government's ambition to avoid a sharp market downturn, this chart might persuade you, and it's a hat tip to Grainier Gilmore at Knight Frank, who produced the data for this particular chart. By lowering the cost of credit and increasing its supply, the government have attempted to keep the market turning, even as prices have only modestly corrected, as I've already touched on. Now, in this chart, we plotted mortgage approvals on a quarterly basis from the start of the crisis, and then we take a look at government intervention. So we kick off here with the collapse in lending back in 2007, 2008. Now, even low interest rates couldn't stem that process. So in 2009, QE begins in earnest, rising from $75 billion through to $200 billion by November of that year. So things are beginning to improve, the market's improving, more activity. But unfortunately, it doesn't last very long. The Eurozone crisis and our own problems in our own economy get in the way, and activity slumps again. So the government's reaction is to try again. The first buy shared equity mortgage scheme comes in, an extra $75 billion of QE. Does it do the job? Well, not really. So in 2012, QE is progressively raised to $375 billion. We've got the new buy mortgage guarantee schemes opened, $80 billion for funding for lending scheme also unveiled. And despite all of this support for the lending market, activity remains fairly flat. So in this year's budget, we have funding for lending extended, but also the new Help to Buy scheme being introduced, or certainly the first element, the equity loan element. And then finally, the big one, the pre-announcing of the Help to Buy mortgage guarantee scheme, the £12 billion limit, pre-announced for January 2014. The reality is, wherever possible, the government have done their utmost to support the market, and that support has helped to keep prices higher than they otherwise would have been. And Help to Buy in particular appears to have aided market sentiment, as shown here on the Knight Frank Market House Price Sentiment Index, which has risen noticeably since the beginning of the year and also since the budget announcements, suggesting that price growth in the short term will be stronger than expected. But over the long term, my view is that high base pricing means the outlook for growth is going to be more subdued. Okay, I want to turn before I finish to two areas I think we can afford to be more positive over in terms of the potential for stronger growth in prices. A couple of surprises for you. You wouldn't be expecting this one. Okay, my first tip is the UK's prime country house market. Maybe no surprise there. But there's a reason for this. The mainstream market I've already touched on. 11% correction in nominal terms since 2008. The country house market, so probably the £1 million-plus market in the regions, has corrected about 23%. So actually pricing in that market back to 2003 levels. And there's a reason for that. This is a discretionary market. It rose faster than the wider market in the final stages of the boom. Now, the reality is a revival in this marketplace depends on the outcome for the London's economy and also the wider UK economy. With pricing differentials widening between prime London and also prime country market, we're seeing the beginnings of a serious uplift in terms of interest from buyers in this sector. And also prices rose in Q1 this year for the first time since 2010. My other surprise, my tip, is London's prime market. Again, just remind ourselves where we are in the marketplace. It's 6 years since the beginning of the global crash. We've had Lehman, endless Eurozone crises, and also a sickly recovery in the UK. And prime London prices around here, 20% higher than they were before the crisis. What does it mean? Well, it confirms the fact that prime London property, or central London property, is one of the so-called safe havens. the asset classes that have benefited from the crisis. Money's flowed around the world looking for some sort of income return or some capital growth or even simply a convenient place to store wealth, and London has been a target and continues to be a target. And as we see here, strong growth in prime London postcodes is not a unique phenomenon. I've compared cumulative growth since Q1 2009 in London with other world cities. And the exception of Miami, London's the only Western city in this top grouping. However you look at it, London's appeal to international buyers, lots of them from the world's emerging markets, has been a critical driver of demand and price growth. But it hasn't been a one-way street for London. In March last year, as I'm sure you're aware, we had the increase in stamp duty from 5 to 7% for 2 million plus. And the market was hit hard initially over uncertainty over some associated rules, but became much stronger after clarification in the December draft finance bill. This chart compares sales volumes by price band in the 12 months to March 2013 with the same period to March 2012. So it's pre- and post-stamp duty changes. Unsurprisingly, the element of the market beneath £2 million has benefited as the element of the market above £2 million has weakened over time. But the interesting finding for me is that the impact of that tax change just falls off almost to zero above £3 million. The very wealthy appear to have taken this tax in their stride. Not to say there aren't real risks for more political activism in this particular area. So how does the central London market look set for the future? I think we've got to think about two marketplaces, the domestic market, so that portion of the market that's dependent on London's economic performance, and that element that you might call the global wealth market, the kind of footloose wealth coming into London. And our recent wealth report confirmed two results that suggest that London is well placed for the future on both of these measures. In the first survey, we confirmed that in terms of economic strength, connectivity, and global influence, London sits at number two globally to New York, and on our second survey, we confirmed that London, in terms of the most important city globally to high net worth individuals, was the top scoring city in terms of a place to do business for these high net worth individuals to educate their children, to raise finance, to network, and also to spend time for lifestyle, etc. And if I finally just touch on that global wealth market for a second in terms of London's context, the interaction between currency and prices has been a critical factor driving London's performance to date. And here I've got an index of relative prices in London for a sterling, euro and dollar buyer. Back in 2008, the yellow line, prices fell 24% in a year in terms of the sterling buyer's perspective. But because of the crash in the pound at the same time, for dollar buyers, the discount was about 50%. And whilst prices have risen around 50 or 60% since the trough in the market, that discount for dollar buyers has remained in place. And if the Economist Intelligence Unit's forecast for currency are to be believed, it looks as if actually that discount could actually increase. And actually, with our forecast and the currency forecast combined, the suggestion here is actually dollar-based buyers will actually hit peak prices again in 2017. So it appears the currency driver will remain a supporting factor for the market. Okay, to finish my forecast, I've got to say these are provided as regional averages. Local submarkets, different price bands, properties are moving at different speeds all the time and will continue to do so. And if I can, I want to divide my forecast into two. I think over the next 12 months, I think the UK will see above inflation house price growth. 3% is feasible. I think there's no doubt that the Help to Buy has injected a degree of confidence into the market which wasn't there prior to the beginning of the year. I think Greater London will be ahead of this, probably 4% for the next 12 months, but I think Prime London will be weaker in the short term. We're forecasting no change in prices in Prime London over the next 12 months. We've got to remember, prices in this market have risen rapidly, and whilst demand remains strong, resistance from buyers is beginning to grow to increasing prices at the current time. However, over the next 5 years, I think the UK will see more constrained growth, probably below earnings growth, closer to 2% a year, and Greater London only marginally better. I think the important thing is there has to be a period of adjustment for earnings growth to move ahead of price growth, which is not to say some regional markets, especially popular towns in the southeast, couldn't outperform in the medium term. For prime London, I think the price growth of 4 to 6% per annum is realistic and probably even conservative over the medium term. But I think the biggest risk to the central London market really is tax and regulation rather than affordability. Thank you very much for listening.
Good afternoon or evening. I'm conscious we've all strayed somewhat over our 10-minute limit, so I shall try and redress the balance. In many respects, I've only really got a couple of things to say, but in customary form, I'm going to say them in a very long-winded way. The first thing, though, that I'd like to remind everyone before we go any further is we're having a debate about property prices when interest rates are not at a 320-year low. And I know Merrin's in the room, and she's going to think I stole this chart of her, but I didn't. I've got it from Bank of England. They're at one quarter of the previous 320-year low. So we are quite literally off the chart. And I want you to bear this in mind as I demonstrate, I hope in the next 10 minutes, how important, how fundamentally essential to property interest rates are, no matter what fiddling at the margins people like George Osborne and others do. So the first thing to bear in mind is that during the property bubble, we had, when interest rates fell, if some of you can cast your minds back to the late 80s, early 90s, it may surprise you to remember that base rates hit 17%. We normally have mortgage rates 200 basis points premium to that. So we basically had 20% mortgage rates in the UK around about 1990. I'm imagining, looking at this room, most of you were alive and many of you were probably owning houses in 1990. So bear in mind, things change. However, we had this fantastic surge in borrowing and this fantastic drop in interest rates that particularly took off around about the year 2000. And assuming the pointer works, so it does, fantastic. So this red line here, this is basically secured debt to disposable income in the UK. So this is mortgages. And you can see that mortgages for a good decade were basically around about the level of 80% of disposable income. So they rise in nominal terms with disposable incomes, but they stayed about 80% of disposable incomes. And then we had that really big drop in interest rates. We had the really tight narrowing of spreads as everyone was trying to expand their balance sheets. This is what I normally talk about, is the banks and Basel II. But what this led to was an increase in the secured debt level in the UK from 80% to 120%, where we are today. So that's a 50% increase. Relative to disposable incomes, these things should mean revert. However, what's really interesting about this increase in debt is that it led to no increase in home ownership. Okay, home ownership is the red and yellow lines, and you can see that from 2000 we had no increase in home ownership in the UK at all. Even more extraordinary, we actually had a drop in the level of mortgage home ownership, which is the red portion. Okay, the red portion in the year 2000. Home ownership with mortgages ran about 10 million, and that has dropped subsequent to that by about 10% or so. So this massive increase in household debt, driven by this massive drop in interest rates from pretty much 20% to pretty much at the lows 3%, led to no increase in demand and no increase in home ownership. It only led to one thing, an increase in house prices. Now, this is absolutely fundamental to all the discussions we're going to have, because what it tells you is, incontrovertibly, that house prices are an inverse function of interest rates. So the reason why house prices went up is because interest rates went down. And you know what's going to happen when interest rates go up? At least relative to disposable incomes? Exactly right. Now, of course, in the government's view, it's very important that we don't let interest rates go up in the near term, because we don't want it to happen, because we can't let the banks, who are still very fragile after their losses on all the other types of lending they've done, suffer the consequences. But what it does mean is that we've got a problem in terms of what we call in statistics mean reversion. With interest rates at 0.5%, that's one quarter of the previous low for the last 320 years, it's pretty damn impossible for interest rates to go any lower. So all we're really talking about now is when interest rates go higher. And when they do, we've got a problem. So just to remind you, other countries in the same position as us have already decided that you might as well get on with it and start dealing with the problem. So you've got house prices falling in places like Spain, where I'm sure they're going to fall further, Denmark, USA, Netherlands, Ireland, but not in the UK. Why not in the UK? Because the banks can't afford it. They can't afford people to go bust. They can't afford, therefore, to foreclose on their properties and be left with a whole bunch of rubbish houses they can't sell. Now, already the FSA estimates that something like 5 to 8% of all the mortgages on the bank's books are actually suffering what they call forbearance, i.e. the banks are letting the guys off. This is after the economy's already let them off by lowering base rates to 0.5%. This is additional forbearance by the banks. For example, shifting borrowers onto interest-only mortgages. By some estimates, we're talking about something like 750,000 mortgages have moved from repayment onto interest-only since the crisis began, and that's during a period when base rates fell from 5.5% to 0.5%. So not normally a time when you'd expect people to be under increased pressure. Now, Yolanda said we wouldn't talk about Northern Ireland because it's a basket case, but it's worth bearing in mind that it's not already impossible to see what a house price crash on the UK or in the UK could look like. Northern Irish house prices have done something quite remarkable. They've fallen more than Republic of Ireland house prices. We have got a doff, a metaphorical cap for them for that. But it's worth bearing in mind that these things can happen. Now, don't forget, what we've done in the UK is we've lowered mortgage rates from an average of around about 6% to an average of around about 3%. So we've halved mortgage rates. Forget base rates. This is the actual, even the mortgage rates. We've halved mortgage rates. So you'd expect that everyone's actually suffering very little. I mean, if your mortgage payments have halved, then obviously you should be doing very well. So it's a bit horrifying to discover that fully 50%, according to a Bank of England poll, of mortgage payers are struggling. And there's even a policist poll that suggests it was more like 70%. So you go, well, why is this? Well, one of the reasons why this is that the benefits of falling rates came quite early. Many people were on two-year fixed-rate mortgages, and, of course, as the 2 years expired, falling interest rates bailed them out. So people who were paying a two-year fixed rate of 6% in 2008 found they were paying a rate of 4% by 2010, so there's a nice big 200 basis point benefit. But by the time we get to 2012, the two-year fixed rate still stuck at around about 4% or just under, so we're not getting any additional benefit there. And so the figures I've talked about date from 2010 and 2011, presumably that hasn't improved at all. Another thing we have to worry about is the fact that of these people who are struggling to pay their mortgages, virtually none of them, less than 10% of the people who are struggling to pay their mortgages, are struggling because of a major life-changing event, like losing their job or having a baby or illness. They're struggling because of finding it difficult to constrain their other half from spending too much, or finding it difficult to deal with increased bills, or finding it difficult to manage cash flows, which is a combination of the two I just mentioned. In other words, very mundane types of environments are making them already struggle. One of the things which the banks have done to try and rescue their situation, having only slowly lowered mortgage rates to the speed at which base rates were lowered, is they've started to sort of bump up arrangement fees. This seems like a good idea because it's some way of making some margin for the banks, but what it does is it disincentivizes particularly poor people from rolling over two-year fixes. If I have a £50,000 mortgage paying 3%, which is what the average on most fixes is now, and I have a £1,500 arrangement fee, as you can see there, I'd be paying £3,000 worth of interest over the two-year term and £1,500 of arrangement fee up front, which means that that increases my interest rate effectively by 50%. If I have a £500,000 mortgage, it increases it effectively by something like 1.3%. So it makes a huge difference in this environment whether you're relatively wealthy or relatively poor, i.e. whether you live in London and South East or somewhere else. But what it also means is that all of these efforts by the banks, by the Bank of England, by George Osborne, are pushing people away from normal repayment mortgages, away from fixed-term mortgages, and towards interest only. One of the reasons driving this is the banks themselves. When they have people coming to them and saying, I'm really struggling with my mortgage, I don't think I can keep paying it, what do you suggest? The number one suggestion by the banks is move to an interest-only mortgage. Now, the reason for this is a quirk of the maths of compounding, but at 15% interest rates, you're paying interest only, you're paying 15%. If you want to have a 25-year repayment mortgage, you only have to increase your annual payments by 0.36%, and over 25 years, you'll pay off your mortgage. Don't believe me? Look up the charcoal mortgage calculator when you get home. At 3%, however, you have to end up paying 5.7%. In other words, you have to end up paying something like 90% more at 3% interest rates to do a repayment over 25 years than someone who's interest only. This is why we've had this miraculous explosion of buy-to-let. A buy-to-let buyer can outperform or outbid a normal owner or occupier every day of the week, because they will be paying literally half as much to have the same property. And that's why many of the owner-occupiers are forced to rent instead and keep trying to accumulate enough for a deposit. But what the banks are doing is they're saying to people, I can't afford right now for you to foreclose or to fail, because I wouldn't want to try and sell your house in this environment. So in other words, if you can afford to pay interest only, pay interest only, I'll be happy with that. So you've got increasingly large numbers of people who are on interest only. This is the interest-only proportion of the total number of outstanding mortgages. The red line shows you the value in sterling. 35% of all mortgages outstanding in the UK by value are interest-only. Not only that, but if you're a first-time buyer, should you eventually save up enough money for the deposit, you can't then afford to pay the payments, or at least not on a 25-year mortgage. So we now have more than half of all first-time buyers paying a mortgage that's more than 25 years so that they can cover the payments. We're sucking in the very last possible people who could be buyers in this market. And when the vacuum is created, where there are no buyers left whatsoever, and then interest rates go up, it's just logic, the remorseless pursuit of logic. So finally, I'll just point out that variable rate mortgage payers. Now, if you think about what interest rates do over time, interest rates go up and they go down. When interest rates go up, you want to be a variable rate payer, because from now on they're going to go down. But when interest rates go down, you want to switch to a fix. So obviously then you're insured against interest rates going back up. In 2007, just over a third of all mortgages in the UK were unvariable. So over two-thirds, or nearly two-thirds, were fixed. But now, because of all these machinations I've been talking about, two-thirds of all mortgages are variable. So everybody, in order to survive in this environment, in order to be able to buy in this environment or just exist in this environment, is being pushed towards interest only. 50% of them are struggling even on interest only, variable. 50% of them are struggling if they're paying their mortgages. Many are being pushed onto interest only. And we have, if I can remind you one more time, the lowest interest rates, not for 320 years, but one quarter of the lowest interest rates for 320 years. There's only one way interest rates can go. We know what falling interest rates do to house prices, they push them up. So we know what rising interest rates will have to do to house prices. And we know just how vulnerable, even at these incredibly low levels, almost the entire mortgage market is. So in the near term, I've put in lots of like nice sort of gently rising prices, because I don't think any of this stuff, I don't think any of this stuff's going to happen in the near term. It's going to happen when interest rates recover, and that's when the banks are fixed. And my personal view is UK banks are still a good 3 years away from being fixed, so I don't think that's a near-term risk. But if we're talking about anything remotely close to strategy, I think you've got to look at the absolute basic fundamentals that drive house prices. I'm not a vested interest in this at all, but as far as I can see, we're looking at the top of one of the biggest bubbles, particularly prime central London, you're probably ever going to see in your lifetime, which may be slightly more controversial than what other people said.